Right. Start to record and share my screen. Right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the third part of our lecture about or the introduction to machine learning. So last week we end up with looking at machine learning in data analysis. So we solved a classification problem using a multi-layer perceptron, and also introduced a few performance measures, such as the ROC curve, the receiver operating characteristics, and the confusion matrix. As I promised last week, today I will like to introduce one or two more classification algorithms, and then we will talk about hyperparameter optimization, which is a very, very important aspect in this field. All right, this is just the introduction. So again, our usual chain of things: we have an input, we have a machine learning algorithm, we have an output. We talked in part one how to handle the input, mainly via data frames. We also talked about how to train a machine learning algorithm, namely a neural network. This has been discussed in part one. In part two, we also discussed how to include validation data and how to avoid overfitting in these algorithms. And in part two, we also looked at the output and tried to get a feeling on how well or bad our model is actually performing, right? If you remember, we had these regression problems where we tried to fit quadratic data, and we looked at residuals or the mean squared error, and in classification the corresponding features would be the ROC curve or the confusion matrix. Exactly. So in part two we looked at an MLP, multi-layer perceptron, but the thing is, sometimes one algorithm might not be, or the algorithm you're looking at might not be the best choice. So today I'm going to introduce, two more classification algorithms, which are an alternative to neural networks. Okay. So from your homework, I hope you took a brief look into the random forest classifier and how they work. If not, I will very briefly discuss the main ideas behind a random forest classifier. So as the main name might suggest, it's a forest and it's composed of several trees, namely decision trees. And the random forest classifier is a very nice example on classifier ensembles, right? Because as I said, a random forest classifier is made up of different decision tree, and each decision tree is a classifier on its own, right? And you can think of there are also models or classifier ensembles that consist of different classifier types. For instance, you could think of an ensemble made of a neural network, one decision tree, support vector machine, and maybe, log likelihood analyzer or something like that. Now, this is sometimes the data is that complicated or that twisted that you have to use these ensembles. However, a random forest classifier is a collection of different collection of classifiers of all of the same type. And brief reminder how a decision tree basically works. So in general, a decision tree works like that. You have your data, you start in the root node, you split the data according to a provided feature, right? You have n features, so you pick the first one and then separate the data accordingly so that you have the best separation and end up with two nodes, right? According to the separation you chose. Then you pick the next feature, like the number is C2 in this case. And again, you start splitting, and the splitting, you stop the splitting or the tuning of this cut or threshold when the purity or impurity is low on the corresponding node. That's fine. So normally a decision tree would tune all thresholds based on all provided features. However, in the random forest, that's why the name is random. Each tree is trained such that you pick out of the features you provide, let's say angle, momentum, and energy, pick a random subset and then optimize on that. That's one thing. Another thing is That in a random forest, let's say you have a random forest with 10 trees, each tree is trained on an individual data set. And this individual data set is simply generated from the initial training set you provide. Okay. So remember in your homework, you call it this function random forest.fit. So, and then you provide X and Y values from your data. So what internally will happen is this data set will be divided into the number of trees you defined. And this is made by mainly done by bootstrapping. Yeah? So basically from the total data set you provide for training, you draw n different samples of, where you randomly draw from the main data set. So this is very nice because each decision tree basically sees a different aspect or subset of the main data set. And it also allows you to train everything in parallel, which is really nice and allows for a speeding up things. Again, I will not talk about the detailed implementation of the random forest because you already did it in your homework. So we will not look at rock curves and confusion matrices because you did this already. So I'll jump to another very common algorithm. That's the support vector machine or SVM. I must admit, I have been working with these things a few times, but I would not consider myself as an expert, but I would not consider myself as a support vector machine expert. So my explanation might be a bit bumpy. I'm sorry for that. So the main idea in the support vector machine is, let's say you have your data, and each data point is represented by n-dimensional vector where small n refers to the number of features, right? So let's say in our data set, where we have three species and three features for each species, in our case, we have each vector would be three-dimensional. Okay. Again, if you have a data set with n events, then each event would be defined by a vector of n dimensions. Okay. So the main goal of the support vector machine is to find a, right, since we are now multidimensional, we find a hyperplane that separates the data best, so that does the classification. You might think of, in case of two dimensions or with two features, you might think of a simple line, right? Hyperplane is just a simple line. And if you go to more dimensions, of course, the line becomes a plane. Here's a nice picture talking about what I'm trying to say. So in this case, we have two classes, green and blue. And the support vector machine is designed such that you'd try to find hyperplane, which is red, that has the largest margin from each of the class, right? And in this case, the classes are already nicely separated, right? And what the support vector machine does is it optimizes this plane such that the distance between the closest green and closest blue is equivalent, right? So this basically guarantees you the best separation, right? So the points closest to this hyperplane, right, indicated by the dashed line, these are the points that basically define the position of this hyperplane in space. So that's why these guys are called the support vectors, right? Because they kind of define your separation plane, whereas this guy here or here, they don't have that much influence on the relative adjustment of this red line or plane. So this is an example for data that is, let's say, linearly separable in two dimensions. Right? However, you can now imagine that sometimes your data is not that nice. You have to allow margins. I haven't found a nice picture for that. So, but just imagine your data is such that one of these green guys, or you have an outlier, that one of these green guys ends up here, or one of these blue guys ends up here. This is a margin. So basically, you allow how many overlap you allow, right? Again, if your data is like completely linearly separable, you don't need to worry about margins. But if you have like a lot of outliers or a few outliers, you might have to consider margin, like how many overlap do you allow? It's sometimes unavoidable. Another thing is, what is when your data is not linearly separable? This is like shown here, right? You have this data, and you see that you cannot do it with a straight line. This is simply not possible. Because if you would draw a straight line or plane, right, you would always have a mixture between full circles and open circles, right, which represent different classes. So what they do then is, or what you might do is include another dimension. So basically, you upgrade your feature space by one dimension, let's say a dot product between features or sum or whatever, right? So basically, you include another dimension and make the data in this new dimensional space linear. And then you can do the super vector machine formalism. This is a nice trick, but it's also, how should I say, computational expensive. Imagine you have a data set of 1 million points, and each point has 10 features, and it's highly nonlinear, right? Then you have to include this kernel transformation, right? So let's say you include, I don't know, the dot product or whatever kernel function you, or polynomial, whatever, and then you have now, I don't know, 11 or 12 dimensions, feature dimensions, right, on 1 million points, and you have to compute all the stuff. So this might be ineffective. So this might be also scikit states that for very large data sets, support vector machine, a nonlinear support vector machine might not be the best choice because it takes forever. Now, what is a linear support vector machine? The one I'm talking about, this is basically the one that assumes that we have linearly or close to linearly separable data. So we don't need to do this trick. So basically, we assume that our data most likely looks like this, and we try to find this hyperplane. How to include this in scikit? Well, you simply call the corresponding library. Then you can define the maximum iterations, right? Like how many times do you the minimization to find the optimum hyperplane? And C is a parameter that steers the performance. So it allows the margin. For instance, C equals to 1.0 is like a very hard margin, right? This would correspond to this case. Allow nearly no crossovers. Whereas if you set C to, I don't know, 100 or so whatever, then you would allow much more overlap. Right? So you make your classifier softer by increasing C. How do you fit it to the data? As usual, you call the .fit command to your training x values and your labels, and then you get the predictions. Okay, fine. And this is the performance. So on the left-hand side, you see the ROC curve, again, for the three species, black, red, and blue, green, sorry, for each of the species. And on the right-hand side, you see the normalized confusion matrix. And you already see that for species two, again, right, you remember for the new network, we observed that species two is not that easy to identify. And also this algorithm seems to have trouble with this guy. Now, as we have the ROC curve for this classifier, we compare to the ROC curve of the neural network, like shown here. And just by looking at these two, you already see that the shape is different, but you also see that the MLP ROC curve seems to be closer to the minimum, to the optimum. So you remember the optimum was at zero false rate and 100% true positives. But of course, you might not say, okay, I look at these two curves, but this is tedious. Imagine you have 5 or 10 species, right? Then you have, right? Then comparing 10 to 10 curves, this might be a bit tedious. I mean, you should always have a look at the ROC curves to see weird features like this weird bump or this shift here. But sometimes it can be helpful to compare numbers, right? So the question is there any other way to compare, let's say, these two models? And yeah, there is, we use evaluation matrix. However, what you learn from this study is also that apparently the linear support vector machine is not the best choice for this classification problem. And this might indicate that your data is not as linear separable as you thought. So you might want to try this and include a kernel. I haven't tried it yet, but this is one test I would certainly do. Or what you could do is, because scikit provides a support vector machine where you can specify the kernel, but as I said, they already warn you that it might take very long for large data sets. Or you, what you can do is you transform your data and include another kernel dimension manually. This is also possible, and then feed it to the linear SVM. This is a bit faster. All right, so evaluation matrix. What are these? Why do we need them? Why should we bother about them? I will explain in a second. All right. As I said, those metrics are used to or shall help you to evaluate the performance of your classifier. Right. We already, or you already learned about the rock curve and the confusion matrix. But again, sometimes, again, if you have a large set of classifiers you want to compare or many species to classify, it might be a bit more helpful or faster to look at the single number. However, a distribution or a multi-dimensional distribution is always, or in most cases, provides more information than a single number. I guess it's obvious. Okay, so last week we already introduced the true positive rate, right? Which is how many signal events or how many events of species one are identified correctly, right? So how many times is the classifier right in its prediction? And we looked at the false positive rate, so how many background events are identified as signal, or how many events that do not contain species one are identified as species one. So how many times is the classifier wrong? And from these two, we already calculated the rock curve and the confusion matrix. But also, these two quantities, the true positive rate and the false positive rate, are ideally universal constants, meaning they do not depend on how many times times each species is abundant in the data set, right? They just depend on the algorithm you trained. I say ideally here because, again, I mean, ideally in case of that you have enough statistics, right, and don't compare one event versus two events. So yeah, these are abundance independent quantities. And we will see in the next slides, we will see some that are not that independent. Many metrics are derived from these two, true positive and false positive rates. So if you, look at in the internet, type in binary classification, you will see lots and lots of pages with some calculations of the F1 score or purity or how they are called. Scikit provides a nice library with these metrics. So if you click on this link, you will see a gigantic list of with a few explanations on how these metrics are derived and what they do and when to use them, and with nice references and papers. So I can highly recommend this, this webpage. As I said, on the following slides, I will introduce a few of these evaluation matrix. Not all of them, because this would just take too long. It would get boring at some point. But I would like to introduce you the ones that are most commonly used and that I'm also more or less used to. All right. The first one, very simple, is the purity. The purity is defined as, let's say you have a data sample and you're looking for species I with your classification algorithm. What you do is you simply count the number of events that contain species I and have been correctly labeled by your classifier. Right? And then you simply divide it by the number of all events that have been identified as species I, so including the wrong ones as well. This quantity basically describes the cleanliness of your data, right? Ideally, when the classifier makes no mistake, then the purity should be 1. If the classifier identifies as many background events as signal and vice versa, then you would have a purity of 0.5. And as I said before, you can also rewrite this expression in terms of the true positive rate and the false positive rate. I spare the details of this calculation. If you're highly interested in this, you can ask me after the lecture. But just trust me that you can use the true positive rate for species I and the false positive rate to express this purity. In doing so, you will notice that you have another quantity called R. I simply call R the percentage of species I presented in the data, right? So R is simply defined as all events that contain species I divided by all events in your data, okay? So it's the relative abundance, basically. And you already see now that by this definition, right? By definition, this quantity, the beauty, depends on how many times each species is presented in data set. This becomes more clear in the following example. So if you now look again at the data we analyzed in this on the last lecture, and look at species 3, then 36% of the entire data is covered by species 3. Okay, that's your abundance ratio R. In part 2, we looked at the multilayer perceptron, and if we pick a certain threshold, we can... So basically, we look at the rock curve and pick a pair of points, right? I picked from the species 3 rock curve, I picked these two points. So for a true positive rate of 92%, we have a false positive. There should be an F, sorry, that's a typo. We have a false positive rate of 20%. Okay. Using the equation from the previous slide, right? So you just plug in the 92% for the true positive, the 20% for the false positive. You put in the ratio, 36% for species 3, and you end up with 72%. So this tells you that for species 3, your data set is like 70% clean. Right? Remember, 100% is the optimum. Again, one has to be careful when using the purity, right? I calculate now the purity on the data set we have analyzed. But imagine... I give you this multilayer perceptron, right? And tell you to use these performance values. If I hand you now over a different data set with a different ratio, which is like, let's say 50 or I don't know, 70% or even less, 10%, then you would obtain a different purity. What I'm trying to say is the purity is also highly dependent on the data set itself, right? Whereas the true positive rate and the false positive rate are ideally not. This is again an example to show you what I'm talking about. This is now the calculated purity where you increase the relative abundance of species 3. Right. So here we have the point. We have this value, the 72% we derived before, for relative abundance of 36% shown here. But let's say we have a data set with where species 3 only makes up 20%, then we would see this purity. If we have a data set where species 3 makes up nearly 80%, then we would have this purity, right? This doesn't mean that the performance of the algorithm is worse. No, the performance is the same, right? Because the true positive rate and the false positive rate do not change. It's just the message is a different one because when quoting the purity, you also have to consider that. You have to consider the relative abundance, right? So be careful when using this quantity. All right. The next one, I don't have an example here. It's just I show it for completeness because it's quoted in many papers and many people use it. So just showing it here for completeness. The F1 score is basically combining the true positive rate and the purity, right? So if you're interested on how efficient is my classifier, but also how clean is the data after using this classifier, you would use this expression. It's basically the product between efficiency and purity divided by the sum. But again, you see that in this quantity, the ratio of the relative abundance is folded in as well. All right. One of the very prominent examples of evaluation metrics is the accuracy. And I want to spend a few seconds on this. So the accuracy is defined, the accuracy of a classifier. So first of all, the accuracy is what I would like to call a global metric because it takes the classification performance on all species into account. Remember? Few slides ago, we talked about the purity with respect to species 3. The accuracy is the performance looking over all species. Basically, it's defined as you sum over all events for a certain species that have been correctly identified. So number of events that have been correctly identified as species 1 plus the number of events that have been correctly identified as species 2 and so on, and then divided over the total number of events in the data set. So you count basically how many times or what's the fraction of your classifier being right. That's what you do. Again, doing some mathematics, you can express this equation into the true positive rate. And using the definition of the relative abundance, you see this. So you can rewrite this equation to the accuracy being the sum over the true positive rate for each species multiplied by the corresponding ratio. Or in other words, which I will show in a few seconds, the accuracy is the trace of the confusion matrix, right? So reminder, the trace is the sum over the diagonal elements of a matrix. As I said, the accuracy is one of the most commonly used evaluation measures or performance measures, but it has been observed that it is not very reliable on imbalanced data, meaning assume you have one species is like 10 times more present than the other one, right? Then you will see that your accuracy is not that a good performance measure. I will show an example that kind of tries to illustrate this issue. Okay, let's calculate the accuracy for the MLP. This is now the unnormalized confusion matrix, right? So remember the one that I showed last week had like just values between 0 and 1. This is just the unnormalized version. So it's the same matrix. It has the same formation. It's just unnormalized. So again, this number tells you how many times a species 1 has been correctly identified by the multilayer perceptron. This indicates you how many times species 2 has been correctly identified and so on. Okay. And the trace of this matrix is simply the sum of these three guys, right? So 102,000 and so on plus 33,000 and so on. So this is the number, this is the trace of this matrix or the sum over all correct identified events. And then you divide it by the total number of events, which in our case is 255,000. Okay. And yeah. So according to the formula I presented before, you just divide these two values by each other. So 210,000 divided by 255,000, and you end up with 82%. And of course, scikit has a function for the accuracy, so you don't have to do this. But if you use this function compared to the manual calculation, they give the same result. So that's consistent. Fine. We could in the next example. We are going to calculate the accuracy for the linear support vector machine, right? The one we discussed before. In this case, the matrix is now normalized, right? So everything has been normalized to the true axis. But that's no problem because we can still calculate the accuracy. Again, we now, since the matrix is normalized, we have to include the relative abundance of each species, right? It's just simple math. So what we do is, we know now that the relative abundance is given by this, right? So species one makes up 46% of the entire data, species two only 18%, and species three only 36%, like I showed before. Now we calculate basically the weighted trace. So R1 times this, the entry, are 2 times this, are 3 times this, like shown here. And we end up at 77%. And it's consistent with the scikit calculation, of course. However, if you now compare before the neural, when we had a neural net, you saw that the identification for species 2 was much worse, but this guy is in the order of 80 or 70 something percent, right? So it's not that bad. But the linear super vector machine has a identification of 42%. But still, if you compare the pure accuracy values, right, 77% compared to 82 in the previous case, you see that this guy is not weighted that much because the corresponding abundance R2 is quite low, right? So what I'm trying to say is, yeah, we can compare the accuracy for both classifiers, but we have to be careful because the performance for species 2 is not that much taken into account here because, again, the corresponding abundance is quite low. Right? We have an imbalanced data set. All right. I wasn't sure whether to show this guy, but the thing is, I will use this coefficient a few slides later. And please don't be scared by the formula. I just put it here for completeness. Whenever you look at these slides again, that you know how this guy is defined. This is the Matthews correlation coefficient. I will not explain this formula in detail, but in a very simplified picture, the Matthews correlation coefficient takes the true positive rate, the false positive rate, and the priority into account for all classes, for all species, and gives you a score where one is basically the best performance. This metric or this performance measure is preferred for imbalanced data because it has been shown that this guy is just capable of, by definition, this guy is capable of handling inequalities among the species. I will give you an example how to use these metrics, right? So remember, we trained now a multilayer perceptron and we trained a support vector machine. And now I can make a table and compare the different performances. And you see, no matter which performance or which performance measure I use, you see that the multilayer perceptron is kind of always the winning guy, right? So this tells you, I might draw my attention rather to this model. I should draw my attention to this model or keep on tuning this guy, whatever. Again, note the relative difference. If you look, for instance, the accuracy, right? If you would look at the accuracy only, you would say, okay, the multilayer perceptron has 82% and the spot vector machine has 77%. So that's just a few percent difference. Right? But if you look at the Matthews correlation coefficient, the difference is much more pronounced, right? 0.72 compared to 0.62. Again, this is partly related to the fact that the Matthews correlation coefficient is more designed for handling inequalities between the species within the data. So you should also keep that in mind. The question is which metric to use. Right? You might now ask, okay, which is the best one? And the answer is, as usual, it depends. I personally hate this answer, but this is unfortunately the only answer I can give you here because it depends on how does your data look like? Do you have balanced data? Is it imbalanced? Are you looking at just one species, right? Because the Matthews correlation coefficient, for instance, doesn't give you any results if you look at one species only. It won't work. Right? It's designed for multi-class classification with at least two classes. Also depends on what do you actually what you're actually asking about. Right? Do you want your classifier to be very efficient because you're looking for very rare species within your data? Do you don't care about efficiency? Do you just want to have a very clean data set so that you don't care how much your main species is suppressed, you just want to have a very clean data set? Or do you just care about the overall performance because you want to have a uniform classification performance? And these are all things you have to ask yourself before using these metrics. All right. Are there any questions so far? Okay. If not, I will continue. Now we come to a very important topic, which is hyperparameter optimization. I will try to make it slow here because this is not a trivial thing. What are hyperparameters? So these are the parameters that kind of determine the performance of your model. Right? During and after the training. I have a small example explaining this. Let's say we look at a polynom of nth order. This is a model, right? And you can fit it to data. I guess you have done this 1,000 times. Then we have different quantities here. We have the parameters p, right? The coefficients. These parameters are obtained during the fit, right? You have your data that is somehow distributed, like let's say third order, and then you would fit a third order polynomial, and whatever algorithm you use, it would spit out these coefficients. These are the fit parameter. These are obtained by fitting your model to the data. What is a hyperparameter? Well, in this case, the hyperparameter is n, the order, right? You can fit, you have to decide, is it the third order, a fifth order, or I don't know. And also, depending on which algorithm you use, the number of fit iterations is also a hyperparameter, right? Similarly, for a multilayer perceptron, right? Remember the feedforward neural network with hidden layers and neurons and whatnot? The weights and biases for each neuron, these are the fit parameters. They are obtained by fitting this multilayer perceptron to the data. These are the fit parameters, right? They are obtained via training or learning. The hyperparameters of this model are the number of neurons, the number of layers, the number of epochs, learning rate, and whatnot. These are the parameters that you have to set up before you start training, right? Random forest, the one you looked at in your homework. The fit parameters are the individual thresholds, the thresholds in each tree, right? Again, they are optimized by fitting to the data. And the hyper-corresponding hyper-parameter would be the number of trees in the random forest, the depth of each tree, maybe the purity and whatnot, right? So these are things you have to set up before you fit the model to the data. Yeah? So these are the hyperparameters. And these are the fit parameters, the ones that come out after the fit, basically. So the main goal of the hyperparameter optimization is to find the set of hyperparameters that gives you the best performance or the smallest loss. You can also include constraint while doing this. You can, for instance, request that no overfitting shall be present, or you can demand minimal computation time. Right? Depends on what you want to do. So what you did in your homework was manual tuning the model. This is basically hyperparameter optimization, but this is painful. Here you see a snapshot of a logbook entry from work I did many, many years ago. I was working on a project at JLab where not completely manually, there was some optimization involved, but where I kind of compared different classifiers with different settings. These are all multilayer perceptrons with different numbers of hidden layers and whatnot, and different features and whatnot, and then I compared the Matthews correlation coefficient. Again, this was done manually because I also looked individually at each classifier, but this was really painful. And there are ways to optimize this. There are many algorithms or frameworks on the market that do this for you. The simplest one is a parameter grid search, and this is the one we will discuss today. It's very, very simple. But kind of ineffective, as we will see in a few slides. But it is quite helpful when you already know your model and the ranges, the parameter ranges you're looking at. Then there's the random parameter search. And then another one that kind of randomly chooses a set of parameters, trains the model, looks at the performance, and chooses randomly another set of parameters, does the fitting, calculates the performance, compares the performance, and then goes into the direction where the best performance. Basically, Bayesian optimization. This is kind of a buzzword again. These Bayesian optimizers kind of include Gaussian processors we discussed last week. So what you do is you pick a set of parameters for, let's say, your neural network. You do the training. You obtain the performance. Then you randomly pick another set of parameters. You do this n times. Then you then you use a Gaussian processor to calculate the intermediate sets of parameters, right? To do a finer grid search and so on. In any case, no matter which method you decide to choose or which framework, you should always include a validation data set, right? Just to because again, you, at the end, you want your model to be able to generalize on unknown data. That's why you should always compare the model performances on validation data set. All right. So I would like to discuss the parameter grid search for multilayer perceptron. Again, as I said, it's not the best choice for hyperparameter optimization, but it's easier to explain the idea behind this method. So we will look again at our classification data. Remember, three species defined by three features each. Fine. And we want to optimize our multilayer perceptrons. So we would like to find the parameter settings that maximizes the classification performance. Right? So we want to find the set of, we would like to know basically which number of hidden layers and number of neurons and which activation function and whatnot gives us, let's say, the best models, however you define best, or the best model, the best performance, which does the best job to classify my data. Again, as I said, it's a grid, we use a grid search. So we define a set of hyperparameters, and each hyperparameter is varied within a specified range that I, meaning the user, have to specify. And then you test all possible combination of hyperparameter settings. Yeah, here's an example. The parameters we are going to test now. Again, remember, we are looking at a multilayer perceptron. And one hyperparameter is the activation function, right? I can use linear, tangents, or the ReLU function. Another hyperparameter could be the number of epochs, right? The number of iterations I update my weights. I set them to 100, 200, and 700. The initial learning rate, right? Remember the learning rate? So basically how fast I allow my gradient search to converge. Shows these values. And of course, the architecture, right? So this is now the notation that is used in scikit. So let me briefly explain. So this means one hidden layer with 5 neurons. This is one hidden layer with 10 neurons. These are two hidden layers, one with 5 and one with 3 neurons. Okay. And remember, these values are just, you know, like initial guess. These, I did not a great deal of research beforehand, right? I just chose these values. If you would do this parameter grid search, you might start somewhere else. I don't know. So what I'm trying to say is they are randomly chosen. Okay. And as you see, so we have 4 hyperparameters, and for each hyperparameter, we have 3 settings, right? So that's 81 settings we have to test, right? So 81 times we have to set up our multilayer perceptron, fit it to the data, calculate the performance, and then amongst the 81 performances, we have to do comparisons. So this might take a while, actually, right? All right. Okay, now step by step, how I want to explain step by step what I did. So first of all, we take the data, right? The three species, three features data, and we split it into a training and validation set. There's a very nice a function included in scikit called train test split. So all it does is you put in your feature values and your target values, and then you say, okay, please divide this data set into 2 parts according to this percentage. So in this case, 25% of this data will be used for validation, and 75% of this data will be used for training. Okay, you can set this one could. Have chosen a larger value or a smaller value. I chose 25%, which is, I think, a common choice, if I remember correctly. Okay, so we have now a training set and a validation set. Now we have to decide which metric do we want to use to judge the performance of our algorithm, right? Remember, we have the accuracy, we could use the purity, we could use the log loss function, we could use the Matthews correlation coefficient. I decided to go with the Matthews correlation coefficient because I already know that our data set is imbalanced, right? And then we have to set up the algorithm that shall be optimized. In our case, it's a multilayer perceptron. So what I do, what one could do, I mean, you don't have to, but what I did is I set up a function that defines a multilayer perceptron, right? Depending on these 4 hyperparameters, we want to tune. the architecture, the number of epochs, the activation function, and the learning rate. Okay. I included early stopping because this is always helpful when you want to avoid overfitting. Okay. So this function is basically called 81 times in our parameter grid search. Right? So 84 times I set up a neural network according to the given set of parameters, and then I do the fitting. So what I do now, I loop over all 81 hyperparameter settings. I train the multilayer perceptron and train data, but I determine the performance, the Matthews correlation coefficient, on the validation data, right? Because we want to look at the performance on the unknown data set. Right? Because we want to choose the model that shows the best performance on the unknown data so that we know that, or that we can ensure that it generalizes well. And then finally, we would like to pick the algorithm with the highest performance. This is in some cases not the best choice. And I hope to show an example next week, but I'm not sure, in the next lecture. However, so imagine we have done all this, we have set up our model, we looped over all 81 parameter settings, and we get this. So on the x-axis, you have 81 different parameter settings. I know this labeling is not helpful, but if you choose, trust me, if you choose another labeling, it gets very messy here and you see nothing. So just imagine that each of these points here on the x-axis corresponds to a certain setting. So a specific activation function, a certain architecture, a certain number of epochs, and the learning rate. Okay. On the y-axis, you have the Matthews correlation coefficient. You see, it kind of wiggles between 0.65 and 0.73. So we already see this is presumably the best performance, presumably. This is the worst performance. It also helps to look at the, how should I say, the width of this variation, right? Let's say you would run into a situation where the width is like, I don't know, let's say your values would all vary about 0.71. This could kind of indicate that your parameter ranges are not chosen wisely, right? Because then, or that your model is simply insensitive with the given data, right? So you have to take a look at this as well. What we now could do is we could ask ourselves, okay, we know what's the best model and what's the worst, but we'd like to know, okay, but which setting has the most impact on the model performance, right? And this is done here. So out of these data points, I picked all model settings which include either the ReLU activation function, the tangents activation function, or the identity activation function. I plotted it as a function of the performance, right? And the first thing you see is, so no matter what kind of setting I use, right? One hidden layer, two hidden layers, small or large learning epoch. As soon as the activation function is the identity, then I won't get any better than 0.65, right? Whereas if I use, for instance, the tangents, this seems to show the overall best performance. Yeah. So no matter which number of epochs I use or which learning rate or which network architecture, I get a pretty good performance with the tangents function. Okay. On the right-hand side, we see the performance depending on the model architecture, right? So one hidden layer with 5 neurons, one hidden layer with 10 neurons, or 2 hidden layers. And we all see they kind of perform a little more similarly, besides these two outliers, which I will discuss in a second. And now I'll compare the best and the worst model. So the worst model has the ReLU activation function, surprisingly, and a learning very small learning rate. So in this case, it just seems that the model just didn't converge. It just stopped in between. And it did optimization, and I included early stopping, but it seems that on the given data set with this activation function, the model just didn't seem to find the optimum, so it stopped too early. The winner is a model with the same architecture, slightly larger learning rate, right? So I kind of made slightly bigger steps in the optimization process, but I convert, basically actually converge to the minimum. Right? If you, and here are the MCC values to see to show you the difference between these two. I can also look at the ROC curves. Right? This is also something you should always do: compare the ROC curves, as I said. And the ROC curves for the winner model kind of look more or less reasonable. But here you see some weird slopes. So it seems that for species three, this simply means that the model doesn't get any better than here, right? So this is already really bad, or something like this. So this is really bad. You should always have a uniform ROC curve. But I can also look at the outputs of my model. This is shown here. So on the left-hand side, you have the worst model, basically, and on the right-hand side, you have the best model output. And you see the losing model also, you see that it has these weird spikes, but it was kind of odd, right? If you look at the winning model, things seem to look reasonable, but yeah, there are these structures here in between, and it seems that the probability curve for species two is kind of squeezed between 0 and 0.6. So this is not good. So this plot basically tells you that you need to go back and restart your parameter search. I mean, even though this model shows the best performance compared to the others, this tells you that you're not done. This just doesn't look healthy. This is not a good algorithm to use in your analysis. Short summary on this grid search. So yeah, I hope I was able to convince you that it is quite easy to implement. Yeah? And it's also easy to understand. So on my laptop, these 81 different settings took about 10 minutes. That's fine. That's not too long. I mean, you can have a coffee in between or, I don't know, prepare slides for a talk or whatever. And we found a winning model with this procedure of 0.73. But again, the response functions do not look healthy, I should say. One comment I should make here is I always use this phrase, the response function doesn't look healthy. I mean, there are cases where the data is that weird or complex and that whatever model you use, you do not get, good-looking response function. In some cases, you just have to live with these structures, some cases. But you should always try to find a model that shows a smooth function without any steps. But sometimes they cannot be avoided. As I said, grid search is very simple and easy to implement, but this is one of the killing arguments. The number of parameters or number of iterations you have to run to load the model, fit the model, evaluate the model is highly depending on the number of hyperparameters you have and this individual settings. So it can easily explode. Can be very time and computing time consuming. But also, and that's actually the worst thing. We spent now 81 iterations on non-calculating stuff, so 10 minutes on my laptop, fine. But it is not guaranteed that we found the best model. Right? Maybe I have to narrow the search in the architecture, or maybe I have to narrow the search for the learning rate. Maybe I have to choose a different architecture at all. One I even didn't think of. Maybe four layers with two neurons each are the best. I don't know. Right? So this is very unsatisfactory. And even in grid search, it might happen that you run your algorithm for a very long time, waste or spend a lot of computing time, but you do not find a proper setting. This might happen. But again, this method, this grid search, is helpful either when you know your model already very well, when you know, okay, these parameter settings don't make any sense at all, or you somehow found a model that has already a good performance and you want to do some fine-tuning. Right? Let's say you set up your model with the best guess initial values and you already come up with a 92% accuracy on 0.92 Mathews correlation coefficient, right? And then you decide to say, okay, yeah, this is quite good, this is promising, but can I push the performance a bit? And you would, in this case, you might do a parameter grid search. All right, This brings me to the summary of part three. We briefly discussed two more classification algorithms. One was the random forest classifier. Another one was the linear support vector machine. Discussed or introduced different performance evaluation metrics, right? The purity, accuracy, the MCC. Again, let me stress that these are not by far not all the available metrics. There are many more which are used, like the area under the rock curve, the AOC, which is basically the integral under this curve. And again, which one to use, this is basically depends on what you actually want to find out about your model. We talked about hyperparameter optimization, right? To tune your model on a given data set, you have to remember that this hyperparameter optimization does not only depend on the parameters you put in, but also on the model. Right? There are different approaches. We discussed the simple grid search, which turned out to be it's working, but we don't know whether we found the best possible model for our data set. On Thursday, we have the final part. And I would like to spend this time there to say a few more words on hyperparameter optimization. And most likely, I will present another approach to do this. But then also, we discuss deep learning, mainly how to set up a deep learn model using TensorFlow. This might be quite interesting. I know there has been a lot of math involved today. Again, I'm sorry for that, but I try to show you how, especially in terms of the evaluation matrix, I try to show you how these quantities are all correlated, right? If someone gives you from your model the true positive rate and the false positive rate, and you somewhat know the abundances of the species in your training data, you can calculate or derive so many quantities. And I kind of wanted to emphasize this in today's lecture. And I think that's all for today. Thanks for listening.
Awesome, thanks a lot. Any questions from anybody?
I have a quick question. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was wondering, in the hyperparameter optimization scheme, if there's some obvious reason why, I guess it seems that we chose, you know, quasi-arbitrarily, it seemed, a bunch of different parameters to test, and then sort of, from what I understand, brute forced our way through seeing which ones were the most efficient. And I'm just curious, is there any way that we could maybe dynamically change the things that we're testing based on prior information, or is maybe like do some sort of random sampling of parameters to test on? I don't know. It just seems like maybe, is there any way to go about getting a better set of parameters to test on, I guess, than just randomly picking?
Yes, and this, yeah, exactly. Basically, you said the buzzwords. It's the what the Bayesian optimizer does. You start initially with a random set of parameters, but then, depending on the performance, you kind of predict. Basically, you make your grid finer by predicting possible parameter configurations, and then go on step by step. And your parameter prediction gets more accurate with each iteration.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay, so Adam, you had a question?
Yeah, is the best way to get familiar with this stuff really just to crack down and start doing it yourself? Or are there any, you know, online courses or anything like that that you would recommend?
There will be a summary of recommendations in the next lecture. I don't have it here, but out of my head, what I can highly recommend, for instance, there are a lot of online courses. I think one of these slides, I put a link to the deep learning summer school that took place last year in Berkeley. There are many slides on this stuff, actually. That there are also YouTube videos of the speakers giving talks and presentation about hyperparameter optimization or neural networks. So that gives you a good feeling. But I don't know. To answer your question, it kind of depends on what type you are, right? I personally are someone who learns a lot by doing it myself, right? Just to see how the stuff works. But if you're a person who is fine with theory and just needs to listen to stuff and immediately understands it, that's fine. Yeah, but there are a lot of online courses, but the one from Berkeley I can highly recommend. This is a really good one.
Okay.
Kyle, did you have a question?
Oh, no, I didn't.
All right. Anyone else? Okay. If not, thanks everyone for coming, and we'll reconvene on Thursday for our last class. Woohoo!
Good. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Talk to you later.
What are you thinking?